Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Panama's former dictator, the CIA spy and convicted cocaine trafficker Manuel Noriega has died. The country.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. When the news reports hit at the end of May that Manuel Noriega had died, you could be forgiven a little if your first thought was, Noriega's still alive? Panama's former strongman has been out of the public eye for a quarter century, since his conviction on drug trafficking and other charges. But also, broadly speaking, our attention has shifted way away from Latin America in recent years, certainly since the war on terror began. It seems like a lifetime ago that U.S. intervention in Panama and El Salvador and Nicaragua was constantly in the headlines. But staff writer John Lee Anderson thinks Noriega is a figure we shouldn't forget about so quickly.
What Noriega represented and began to personify, which was this kind of merging of the backwash of the ideological world of the 60s and 70s and 80s in Latin America with the drug culture and the world that we now know has consumed a lot of our neighbors to the south. Because to a large extent, we helped make it happen.
In 2015, Anderson interviewed Noriega, one of the few interviews he gave during his many years in prison.
¿Qué opina hoy en día de gente como Bush Padre? O sea, como en una palabra, Bush Padre.
Él lo heredaron por ese sistema americano del lobby.
Here's John Lee Anderson talking with The New Yorker's Dorothy Wickenden.
So how did you find yourself in a room with Manuel Noriega?
Well, Panama is a country I go to and I have been going to for 30 years. I had long since given up any hope of interviewing General Noriega. He'd been in prison for many years, decades, and I kind of forgot about it. And about a little over a year ago, I was in Panama having dinner with an old friend who's an old friend of Garcia Marquez and had at one point worked for Noriega. And he'd invited me to dinner to a fish restaurant. In the middle of the dinner, he asked me if I'd like to meet the comandante, who by now was back in Panama in prison and sentenced to many, many years. And of course, I said yes. So September before last, we quietly went out and I spent a couple of hours with him in his prison. This was an icebreaker, and we were supposed to hit it off. And we kind of did hit it off.
Well, I want to pause right there, because he was, when I read one of his obituaries, I think it was in the Washington Post, and Colin Powell, who was head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the time of the invasion, described him as pure evil. Did he strike you as pure evil?
No, he didn't. When he was in power, he was pretty thuggish. But, you know, I met a lot of other people who, including people who worked for our interests, so to speak, in Latin America and elsewhere, who were pretty much pure evil. But he existed in that netherworld where, you know, strategic interests collide with the real world. You know, he was a double or perhaps triple agent. He was our man, but wasn't our man. He was also Cuba's man, but wasn't their man.
So let's back up just for a second. He played an enormous role in U.S. foreign policy at the time in the 70s and 80s. Tell us briefly about his rise to power, and then how he managed to hold on for so long.
Right, exactly. Well, so Noriega rises through the ranks of the Panamanian military, the National Guard, at the elbow of General Torrijos, a charismatic strongman who seized power in 1968. And had a relationship where he temporized with the Americans, who, of course, controlled the Panama Canal Zone. We had military bases across the country. Noriega was his useful aide-de-camp. He was the intelligence chief in the country. He was a man of humble origins who rose through the ranks of the military. He didn't have the public persona or the charisma of Torrijos. He helped him put down a coup at one point. He became his go-between with various intelligence services. By the time Torrijos died in a mysterious airplane crash in 1981, he took over the country. He became the de facto leader of the country. I saw him once in those years, by the way. It was at an event commemorating Torrijos' birthday. And it was on a lawn in the canal zone, and suddenly Noriega showed up. And he was at the height of his powers. And he and his people arrived, and it was like a cold air just came through. And I'll never forget, my hair stood on end because I realized that Noriega had this shark-like ability to look at you sideways. His eyes were very wide around his head. So he could look at someone, say, in profile to you, but appear to be looking at you as well, like a shark passing you in the water.
Did you speak to him?
We shook hands, but I remember it was very brief and peremptory. No. And I didn't want to. I was frightened of him at the time. Noriega came out of the shadows in the 1980s, and at a time when the Reagan administration ramped up its national security doctrine in efforts to undermine Marxist-backed insurgency in the hemisphere, to undermine the Sandinista regime in Nicaragua.
And was this when the CIA recruited him?
Well, the CIA apparently recruited him earlier. When we spoke, he denied being an agent as such, but apparently he did receive a salary for many, many years.
So you actually have that interview recorded, right?
Yes, 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 I recorded it.
Y tener relación con la CIA a la misma vez. ¿Cómo lo hacías?
Yo no soy de que miembro de la CIA. ¿No?
Claro.
Yo llego a la CIA.
What is he saying there?
I'm saying, how can you be? He says he's from. I said, were you an anti-communist? He says, no, I was on the left. I said, well, how can you be someone with revolutionary aspirations and have a relationship with the CIA? And he said, I wasn't an agent of the CIA. He said Torrijos, his boss, his late boss, had asked him to develop the relationship with the CIA because Torrijos believed the CIA wanted to overthrow him. So he wanted Noriega, his man of trust and confidence, to basically be able to look them in the eye regularly and make sure that they were kept at bay. You know, you don't want the CIA on the wrong side, so let's keep your enemy closer. That was how he claimed the relationship evolved.
And did the CIA get anything in return? He was a so-called asset, but did that?
Apparently, yes. Apparently, he was, at that whole period, remember Oliver North, Iran, Contra scandal, Noriega was in the thick of it. You know, arms came and went from Panama to the various guerrilla fronts that the CIA wanted guns to get to.
Noriega, did he not, approached Ollie North to see if he could undercut the Sandinistas, the left-wing Sandinistas?
Yeah, I mean, I take what Oliver North says with a grain of salt, of course. But there was a lot, you know, Noriega at that time, at the height of American involvement in El Salvador and Nicaragua, Noriega was a key agent. He was, you know, seen to have a relationship with our CIA chiefs, with, the first President Bush. And everybody seemed very happy with him. He discomfited a lot of people because he also developed a relationship, for instance, with Gaddafi in Libya.
And he was a major drug trafficker at a time when the war on drugs was underway.
That's right. What Noriega, I asked him directly if he had a relationship, and he denied it.
Ahora, tocamos el tema este de narcotráfico y lo demás. ¿Fuiste narcotraficante?
Jamás.
¿Fuiste? ¿Te lucraste de...? ¿Hiciste trato con Pablo Escobar?
Nunca, ni lo conocí. Por eso te digo todo.
So that's something about traficante. Tell me more.
So I said, come on, so they've accused you. You were convicted of being a narcotrafficker. What's the truth? Were you a narcotrafficker? Did you do a deal with Pablo Escobar? And he said, never. And then we talked for a while. And eventually he said, but the gringos, the Americans, did ask me to let the narcos launder their money in Panama's banks so that they could follow the money. And I let them do that.
Wow, that's amazing. John, what's...
Yeah, so Noriega's basically saying what the Americans asked him. They're saying, we want to be able to follow the money, find out who the people are, where the money's going, how they're doing it. And they didn't have any way of following it at the time, so he arranged it. And now, I mean, at this, you know, by the time I spoke to him, was this an alibi? Was it the truth? I kind of felt that it was a half-truth, that yes, they probably did ask him that, and he probably did arrange for the money to be laundered. You know, I was hearing as a young reporter running around Central America about him and drugs several years before the Americans turned on him.
So let's talk a little bit about how the what led up to him being busted. There was that grisly murder of Hugo Spadafore, whom you had just spoken to right before he was killed.
I knew Hugo Spadafore. That's right. In Costa Rica, I met Hugo Spadafore. He sought me out. He was a very interesting character. He was a very romantic character, kind of a Che-like figure. He was dashingly handsome. He fought, you know, the good fight against Somoza in the 70s with the Sandinistas. But then he turned on the Sandinistas, and he had just been fighting against them. And now he had emerged from the jungle. And we met in this hotel in Costa Rica. And I remember we spent 5 hours together. And he was on his way back home to Panama, where he said that's where the battle has to be fought, because Noriega was a killer, a drug trafficker. He was, you know, double dealing with the Americans. He was all things evil, much as Colin Powell later said. And he, Hugo Spadafore, planned to move against him. And, you know, it was not long afterwards that Spadafore was disappeared and his headless body was found in northern Panama. As he tried to return to Panama on a bus, two National Guardsmen or a number of National Guardsmen removed him from the bus. And apparently they sawed his head off while he was alive. And the brutality of the murder, the gruesomeness of the murder, it was so unusual for the region, especially for Panama. And it seems so obviously to have been directed by Noriega.
What did Noriega say? You must have asked him about this in your interview.
Well,
your
at the time, he denied it. He said he was on a trip.
Let's hear what he has to say.
¿Cómo fue eso del caso Spadafore? ¿Fue gente suya que lo mató pensando que estaban cumpliendo con
su voluntad? I asked if maybe some of his guys had done it as a favor to him.
No fue tan romántico así.
And he answers, well, it wasn't so romantic as all that.
Primero, vamos a poner mi situación. No estaba en el país.
Sí. What he repeated to me was what he had said at the time was that I couldn't have done it. I was in London. And, you know, I just thought, oh, I can't believe you just said that to me. And that was the one time in our interview, our conversation, really, that I felt that he was just lying through his teeth.
Was this the end as far as the administration was concerned? Now we're...
No. No, it wasn't. So that was happening in 1985, and it wasn't, of course, until the end of 1989 that the Americans moved against Noriega. No, he was still Washington's man, and he was for a few more years. But, you know, it was only in the sense that it began to roil the waters in Panama. He began to have a domestic opposition that was vocal, which for a while he managed to control, because it initially, and I remember seeing those demonstrations, it was on the lunch hour in the financial district in Panama. Everybody would come out in their white clothes like Calvin Klein's. The middle class men and women would leave their banking jobs and go around the streets honking horns in their cars for 2 hours. And then eventually, as this carried on, Noriega started fielding his own sort of mobs who were coming from the barrios, you know, the periphery. And they were darker skinned and they were carrying machetes and sticks. And he called them the dignity battalions. And the more this went on, the more it became a kind of class war. And he began to channel his inner leftist, I guess.
Toward the end, he really went rogue. And it was 1989. And he essentially dared the Americans to take him on. Didn't he wave a machete over his head?
Yeah, he did. It's kind of a gentler, sweeter time when people actually thought they could do that and get away with it. Tensions ramped up severely between the Americans, who were, of course, military and in the zone, and his own military. When the end finally came for him was after an incident where some of his people stopped a group of American soldiers who were driving through Panama City, and in whatever happened, one of those Americans died. Within 4 days, the invasion had happened. This was the first major military action by the United States since Vietnam.
A Washington, como lo hizo en esa época, no lo hacía cualquiera, y pagó duro.
What's he saying?
I said, you know, you paid a high price for your emotionalism and you took on the empire. And he said, yeah.
De qué manera?
I said, so would you do it differently? He said, yeah. I said, what would you do differently? He said, well, time has taught me to negotiate.
The this was a major U.S. foreign policy mm-hmm. embarrassment, this entire episode, which took place over well over a decade. Did we learn anything from this?
Well, I'm not sure we did. It was interesting because, you know, within a year and a half of each other, right at the time the Soviet Union was falling apart, you had George Herbert Walker Bush as president inheriting from Reagan. During his first 2 years in office, he ordered major police actions, wars really, against two allies who'd gone rogue, Saddam Hussein and Noriega. Saddam Hussein, the first Gulf War, came a year later. And that's why taking out Noriega and the Panama invasion was quickly forgotten about. You know, it was dealt with. Then came the collapse of the Soviet Union and the first Gulf War all at the same time. And what had happened in Central America just became a footnote to history.
What was the very last question you asked him?
Well, I asked him about teddy bears.
Eso es una colección de osos peluche uniformados. Cuéntame la historia, el origen de eso.
You hear his laugh, right?
Yeah.
There were these teddy bears tacked to the wall in the room, and it was the most bizarre thing. Here was Manuel Noriega, the evil guy, and there were
the
these teddy
man.
Bears, the strong man, and there were these teddy bears on the wall, and I asked him about them, and he explained that they were part of an old, paratroopers tradition of every time you get a jump.
America, U.S.
The U.S., of course, then they had formed him. He was a creature of the U.S., military training and their rituals, and he liked it. he told me he wasn't really resentful of the Americans.
Oh, yeah.
He kind of said, everybody did their job. They did what they had to do.
A ver.
Staff writer John Lee Anderson speaking with The New Yorker's Dorothy Wickenden. John Lee interviewed Manuel Noriega in 2015 when Noriega was in prison in Panama. He died last month.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.